of Rio Salado College. For more information, visit sunsounds.org.
At 8 o'clock, we now continue with the live reading of the Thursday, August 8th issue of the Arizona Republic. Our readers this morning are Alex Schaefer and Jean Gazeking.
And welcome back, Sunsound listeners. We'll begin this hour with today's obituaries. Scott Brian Agee, 49, of Phoenix. Yasmin Banner Duncan, 62, of Phoenix. Georgia Della Parioni, 69, of Peoria. Willis Brooks Daly, 87, of Ahwatukee. Glenn E. Twiggins, 86, of Sun City. Mark Howard Gershaw, 58, of Surprise. Josephine Josie Gonzalez, 70, of Phoenix. Marceline Hagen, 91, of the Valley. Timothy John Hancock, no age given, of Phoenix. Kathleen Marie Hedgecock, 69, of Glendale. Judith Houlihan, 75, of Glendale. Herbert W. Highland, 91, of Phoenix. Glenda Lee Odom, 80, of the Valley. Barbara Jane Plummer, 84, of Scottsdale. James O. Wentworth, 76, of the Valley. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the family and friends of these individuals. For more information regarding details for any of these listings, please call Sun Sounds of Arizona at 480-774-8300.
And now we move on to the business section of the paper. We have one article from the Associated Press out of New York. FedEx severs deliveries for Amazon. FedEx will no longer make ground deliveries for Amazon as the online shipping giant builds its own fleet and becomes more of a threat to delivery companies. The announcement Wednesday came 2 months after FedEx has terminated its air delivery contract with Amazon. Traditional retailers such as Walmart and Target want to sell more of their goods online, which in turn allows FedEx to distance itself from Amazon without suffering the same competitive damage it might once have. Citi research analyst Christian Weatherby said in a note to clients, "This does not come as a surprise to us. The company is clearly trying to move away from its partnership with Amazon, and we believe it is using this move as a selling point to win new, non-Amazon business." Amazon is growing its own fleet of air and ground transportation, giving it more control of how its packages are delivered, while reducing its reliance on FedEx, UPS, and the U.S. Postal Service. Amazon has been leasing jets, building package sorting hubs at airports, and launched a program that lets contractors start package delivery businesses with vans stamped with the Amazon logo. Last month, FedEx warned for the first time in a government filing that Amazon's fledgling delivery business could lower prices, hurt its revenue, and, quote, negatively impact our financial condition and results of operations, unquote. It was a departure from the previous statements by FedEx officials and those at UPS who have long downplayed the idea that Amazon could become a competitor in the delivery business. They noted that it took many years and billions of dollars for their companies to build worldwide networks of planes and delivery trucks. FedEx chairman and CEO Fred Smith said during an earnings call way back in December, "We look at Amazon as a wonderful company and service, and they're a good customer of ours. We don't see them as a peer competitor at this point in time. For many reasons, we think it is doubtful that that will be the case." Well, Amazon doesn't say how much of its packages flow through FedEx, but it's likely a much smaller amount compared to UPS and the U.S. Postal Service. FedEx said that Amazon made up just 1.3% of its total revenue in 2018. That's about $850 million. Amazon said in a statement Wednesday that FedEx has been a great partner over the years, and we appreciate all their work delivering packages to our customers. In addition to building its own delivery business, Amazon wants to deliver packages to shoppers' doorsteps even faster, which is proving to be a bigger expense than expected. Last month, Amazon admitted it will cost more than the $800 million it had said it would spend to switch its prime two-day delivery promise to one-day delivery. The higher costs were related to reconfiguring its warehouses and moving products and goods to facilities that were closer to its customers. Analysts said FedEx will still have a role in moving some Amazon packages, but it would be an even smaller part of its business. Stifel analyst David Ross wrote in his note to clients, "This will make it not worth mentioning." And that's FedEx server severs deliveries for Amazon.
And I'm going to start the sports coverage with an item of special local interest. Mesa's Belgian wins Arizona Open by Julia Stumbo, Arizona Republic USA Today Network. When the final round of the Arizona Open kicked off on a cloudy Wednesday morning at the Superstition Mountain Golf Course, PGA Tour member Charlie Belgian was two strokes off the lead. Tied for third place, the Mesa native knew he had to make up ground if he wanted to redeem himself from last year when he tied for second in the same tournament. On the first hole, he birdied. On the next hole, he made another birdie. On the next, another. "I got out to a dream start," Belgian said. "I birdied the first three holes and five of the first six. You can't ask for anything more." His impressive start helped him surge ahead of the pack, and by the end of the day, Belgian would claim the 76th Arizona Open Championship with a one-shot win over Zach Smith. By hole number seven, Belgian took the lead and never let up, but the trophy was up for grabs until the very last stroke. Despite Belgian's strong start, Smith, another Arizona-born golfer who was playing his first event as a professional, kept pace after starting the day at an 11 under par. Heading into the turn, Belgian over-putted a few holes, missing birdies by a matter of inches. At the turn, he sat just one stroke ahead of Smith. Belgian and Smith were rarely more than a stroke or two apart, with Smith hot on Belgian's heels throughout the entire round. Belgian, however, says he never knew how close it was. "I never looked at the scores to see what anybody did," Belgian said. "I just played my own game and came out one or two strokes ahead." Heading into hole number 18, Belgian was 16 under par. Smith, one hole behind, sat at 14 under. Belgian was hoping to pad his lead by a stroke or two, but things went awry off his final tee. "I didn't have enough club to get to the green," Belgian said, "so unfortunately I had to lay it up and then almost made the putt for birdie, but then made a par." With Smith two strokes behind and one hole to go, he needed an eagle to tie Belgian and send the tournament into a sudden death playoff. Smith, unlike Belgian, had been watching the scores closely. As he teed up for the last time, he knew what was at stake. "I saw that I was kind of one behind him the whole day, so I tried to take some chances but still not play too aggressive," Smith said. Two strokes in on the par 5 hole, Smith found his ball in the fringe. With Belgian watching from the sideline, Smith chipped the ball up and got it within inches of the hole, coming just short of the eagle he needed to catch Belgian. "It was a sigh of relief, but at the same time, I was ready to go back to a playoff if I had to," Belgian said. Belgian finished the three-day tournament going 69, 66, 65, 200 on the par 72 Superstition Mountain course and earned the first-place prize of $16,000. Even after missing a head-to-head playoff by inches, Smith, 67, 66, 68, 2001, was all smiles as he shook Belgian's hand after the tournament. "It was my first tournament as a pro, so I'm pretty happy with the outcome," Smith said. Coming in third was dark horse Michael Feagles, a Scottsdale-born amateur from the University of Illinois, who started the final round at 5 under. By the end of his round, he was at 14 under with 8 birdies and 1 eagle. I practice a lot of the time with some really good players, some good professionals, so it wasn't too abnormal for me to be playing with some guys who do it for a living, Fiegel said. But at the same time, it's always nice to compete at the highest level. I just kept the ball in play, kept it in the fairway, and gave myself some chances. Fiegel's rose 16 places with his 63, the low round of the week, and ended the tournament as the lowest scoring amateur, 14 under 202. And that was Mesa's Belgian wins the Arizona Open.
Going Live by Bob McManaman. It's been said that few people know Cardinals quarterback Kyler Murray better than Cardinals head coach Cliff Kingsbury. And there is plenty of truth to that. Kingsbury has known Murray since Murray was just a kid. He tried recruiting him since Murray was a sophomore in high school. Over the years, they've remained close and developed a strong synergy to their relationship. So, if anyone would know if Murray will have any jitters when he and the Cardinals hit the field for Thursday night's preseason opener against the Chargers, it ought to be Kingsbury, right? Kingsbury said, I'm sure he'll be more amped than nervous. He's a competitor. He gets butterflies just like anybody else, but he loves it when the lights are on. Turns out, Kingsbury nailed it, more or less, because this is what Murray had to say when someone asked him if he'll have any nerves entering his Cardinals debut at State Farm Stadium. He said, I don't really have too many nerves right now. It's the preseason. I'm looking forward to having some fun. As Kingsbury has often said since the Cardinals selected Murray with the number one overall pick in this year's draft, nothing seems to be too big for the 5'10" dual-threat quarterback. When the lights come on and the NFL Network televises his first real live foray into pro football, you can probably expect Murray to be his cool, confident, savvy self. Murray said, how juiced am I? Well, I'm pretty excited just to play an actual football game against an opponent other than my teammates, even if it's just preseason. You know how much it means. It doesn't mean too much. But obviously, everyone wants to go out there and have a good showing. Whether it happens or not, it's just getting ready for the actual season. That's when the lights will really turn bright, on September 8th, when Murray and the Cardinals open the regular season with a home game against the Lions. It figures to be one of the most anticipated debuts of any Valley pro athlete in decades, if not history. And that's still a month away. So what would constitute a good showing for Murray against the Chargers? He said, well, complete a couple of balls, maybe score a touchdown or something. Well, what about turning on the Jets at least once to have the Arizona fans and a national TV audience catch a glimpse of his impressive running ability? Murray said, if it happens, it happens. It might happen. Part of the suspense surrounding Thursday night's game isn't just waiting to see what Murray may or may not do. It won't be just watching how quickly he zips his passes or how accurate his throws are or if he tucks the ball down and scoots. It's wondering how much he will play in his very first game. Kingsbury hasn't offered anything concrete. One day he joked, you have to tune in to find out. Another day, he said Murray's playing time against the Chargers will be based on in-game live evaluations. Kingsbury said, the goal for us is to get him out of the game feeling good about him, feeling good about what went on out there. So, whatever that takes. If it's 3 plays, it'll be 3 plays. If it's 10, 12 plays, it'll be 12. I think we'll just figure that out as the game is going and how he feels and go from there. The main objective is to get good work, have him feel comfortable, and feel good about the result. Murray said he doesn't plan to lobby for any more playing time than Kingsbury is willing to give him. He also said the Cardinals' first-team defense had been giving him more than enough complicated looks to have him fully prepared to face the Chargers. Throwing against a top-flight cornerback in practice every day like Patrick Peterson has also helped, he said. I don't think he's out there just babying me or anything like that, Murray said. As for what fans can expect to see out of Kingsbury's up-tempo spread offense, most of it will be kept under wraps until the regular season. The Cardinals plan to run their base install, according to Kingsbury, who added it may not be pretty because of that. There will be times, however, when Kingsbury will let Murray do some freelancing, whether that involves changing the play at the last second, calling his own number, or making something happen out of nothing. The coach said, "You walk that fine line. You still want to see what you can get away with and what you can't at this level, playing against some of the top caliber competition. So we'll see how it goes." Some quarterbacks, such as former Cardinals signal caller Carson Palmer, liked to get hit a few times during preseason games to get themselves into regular season mode. Considering Kingsbury knows Murray as well as anyone, does the coach think his rookie quarterback wants to absorb a few knocks? Kingsbury said, "I haven't talked to him about it, if he's one of those guys. There are certain guys that feel that way and want to get hit. It kind of loosens them up, so we'll see. Knowing Kyler like I do, I don't think he wants to get hit that much. He tries to avoid that." Kingsbury is right again. Murray said he hasn't been hit since Oklahoma's 45-34 Orange Bowl loss to Alabama last December, and he's not looking forward to getting hit on Thursday. He said, "I hope I don't get hit. It's football. If I get hit, I get hit. It is what it is. I've gotten hit, and I've hit many people plenty of times. It's just part of the game." And that was the article, Going Live, by Bob McManaman. And that game, the Chargers at the Cardinals, will be tonight at 7 p.m. on Channel 12 on TV.
And turning to college football, Sun Devils quarterback competition down to three, by Michelle Gardner, Arizona Republic, USA Today Network. And then there were three. Arizona State entered fall camp with four players, junior Dylan Sterling Cole and freshmen Jaden Daniels, Joey Yellen, and Ethan Long, competing for the role as starting quarterback. However, ASU head coach Herm Edwards said Wednesday that Long is no longer contending for the starting spot, although he will remain a quarterback and will likely be featured in some Wildcat formations. "Can't say enough about that guy," Edwards said, referring to Long. "Can't say enough about him and Cole Cabral. When you think about the team and what we're asking them to do." Cabral, a senior, moved from his position at center to left tackle because of the needs of the team. Edwards said both Cabral and Long are willing to play where they are most needed. During fall camp, Long has lined up at receiver, and Edwards has said he could also be used on defense as well. "He keeps telling me, 'Coach, when are we working on defense?' Long might be a defensive guy too. We'll see," Edwards said. "I know one thing, he has to be good on the field. He has to be on the field. He's too good of an athlete. He's earned the respect of every guy on this football team because of his character and how he works." National speculation has either Sterling Cole or Daniels getting the starting job. However, Yellen certainly isn't out of the mix. Sterling Cole, the 2018 backup to starter Manny Wilkins, has appeared in 13 games for the Sun Devils. He is 28 for 57, passing for 388 yards and one touchdown with four interceptions. Out of high school, Daniels had 25 offers, including Ohio State, Georgia, LSU, and Alabama. His high school numbers were staggering. He started 53 games and completed 921 of 1,389 pass attempts, 66.3%, for 14,007 yards with 170 touchdowns and 25 interceptions. He also had 562 carries for 3,645 yards and another 41 touchdowns. Yellen, a pro-style quarterback, completed 360 out of 595 passes, or 60.5%, for 6,131 yards while throwing for 57 touchdowns with only 14 interceptions in his two seasons as a high school starter. Offensive coordinator Bob Likens is hoping to name the starter by August 15th, 2 weeks before the team's first game. The idea would be to give the starting quarterback time to face the pressure that comes with the job before taking on Kent State on August 29th. Likens said he is using the time at Camp Tontizono to put the quarterbacks in situations to see what each can handle. "Only then can you really see their decision-making," he said. "Red zone, goal line where the field gets shorter and the decisions have to come quicker. I think you will be able to see some separation in guys in those situations. Wednesday's practice featured a two-minute drill. Thursday will be red zone. That was Sun Devils quarterback competition down to three.
Next, we have Kent Summers' column, Fitz Sarver Develop Unique Friendship. Friendships between people of divergent talents, ages, colors, genders, and personal habits often pique our curiosity. If they didn't, there wouldn't be nearly as many sitcoms and buddy movies. We were reminded of that a couple of weeks ago when an enterprising citizen distributed via social media pictures of Suns owner Robert Sarver and Cardinals receiver Larry Fitzgerald riding bicycles on Coronado Island in San Diego. Fitzgerald spent time with family there too, but the outing near Sarver's home in the San Diego area highlighted just how close he and Sarver are. It was an off day during training camp for Fitzgerald, and players usually are looking to put their feet up on those days, not riding bikes. The relationship seems incongruous on the surface. Fitzgerald is the most popular athlete in Arizona, perhaps in the state's history. And Sarver, whose team hasn't been to the playoffs in 9 years, is probably the most reviled person on the Valley sports scene. Larry rolls off the tongues. Sarver overstays its welcome there. So what do the two see in each other? Sarver declined to be interviewed about his relationship with Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald, in contrast, doesn't hesitate to profess his fondness for Sarver, and there's not a long line of people ready to do that these days. I think people judge him unfairly. First of all, because they don't know him like I know him, Fitzgerald said last weekend while promoting a fundraising dinner for his foundation on August 26th. He's one of the smartest and most compassionate men I know. I'm a better man, a better businessman, for knowing him over the last few years. We've known for a while that Fitzgerald and Sarver were fast friends. We've seen pictures of them sitting together at Suns games and scouting Ja Morant at the Ohio Valley Conference Tournament. A few weeks later, Fitzgerald was with Sarver when he interviewed general manager candidates. Fitzgerald downplayed the significance of that at the time, saying he just wanted to learn more about business. Fitzgerald is naturally curious, and he's as likely to strike up a conversation with a stadium maintenance worker as a CEO. He's also determined to make his life more than a one-act play. The next act is to succeed in business, and few people have done that as well as Sarver. Sarver has let Fitzgerald behind the curtains to see how that's done. His advice to Fitzgerald has gone far beyond saving for a rainy day and maximizing his 401k contributions. Fitzgerald said, "I relish every opportunity I can be with him. Not only has he helped me, but also a bunch of my friends. Deals we're involved with, he looks over, tells us the positives, the negatives. The guy, he's a genius." Developing that kind of relationship with players was the theme of a speech Fitzgerald gave to NFL owners during league meetings last spring. He encouraged them to not only advise players to be wise with their money, but also to show them how to do it. Fitzgerald told the room of billionaires, "You can shape the outcome of their lives." And players, Fitzgerald said, have to be willing to speak up. He said, "Closed mouths don't get fed." But the relationship between Fitzgerald and Sarver is not one-sided. There are indications that Fitzgerald is doing more than just observing Sarver in action and asking him to look over deals. Fitzgerald's also advising. Well, that's good news for the Suns and their fans, even though Fitzgerald has never played, coached, or managed in the NBA. But he's an avid sports fan who follows nearly every league. More importantly, he's been able to see what works and what doesn't during his 15-plus seasons in the NFL. No other player has done a better job maximizing his value and maintaining leverage in contract negotiations. Fitzgerald has a keen interest in business, and no one in sports has ever been better at public relations. It's hard to imagine he's not advising Sarver about what the owner's role should be with the Suns. It might be one reason we've seen Sarver take a lower profile over the last year. Fitzgerald wouldn't admit to any of that, and he's adamant that Sarver is misunderstood. Fitzgerald said, "I know he's going to get that organization turned around. I'm a huge Suns fan. I go to a bunch of games. I know a lot of the players, and I look forward to this season starting up in October. I like the acquisitions we made." So, Fitzgerald was asked, "Has Sarver sold you a piece of the team?" Fitzgerald said, "Sold me a piece of what?" The response was, "The team." "Oh, yeah, right. Well, we'll see. I'll ask him and see what he says." I'm betting the question has already been asked or brought up by Sarver. And I'd bet a house on Coronado that the answer was yes. And that's Kent Summers' column, "Fitz Sarver Develop Unique Friendship."
And Mercury's Asia Taylor cherishes every chance by Jeff Metcalf, Arizona Republic, USA Today Network. Jobs are hard to come by in the 12-team WNBA and not always easy to keep. Asia Taylor learned to live with such vagaries and to appreciate any opportunity, like her latest with the Phoenix Mercury. She was signed to a 7-day contract as a hardship roster exemption due to injuries and will be in uniform for games at Los Angeles on Thursday and home against Dallas on Saturday. After that, who knows? It depends on when some of the 5 injury Mercury players begin to return, starting with Breanne January, who is out for a 2nd straight game Thursday. Erica Carter played Sunday as a roster exemption, and now Taylor gets her chance, both coincidentally being from Louisville. Carter is a WNBA rookie, while Taylor graduated in 2014 and has spent more time clawing for a job. Together, they give the Mercury 9 active players. "My years in the league have been where I'm good enough to make teams, but I'm always playing behind superstars," Taylor said Wednesday. "When I went back to Minnesota, it was the opportunity where the superstars were hurt, so now the coach has to play you. I just showed what I can do when I actually have minutes." The 6'1 forward scored a career-high 13 points in 17 minutes in a Lynx win over Chicago on July 10th. But even that only brought her 5 more games before she was released July 25th as Minnesota players, including Simone Augustus, got healthy. Taylor played in 24 games with Washington in 2017, 22 with Minnesota 2014. 14 with Indiana 2018 and 4 with Connecticut 2016 before returning to the Lynx for 8 this season. She's also had considerable success in the Australian WNB, putting her on the radar of Mercury coach Sandy Brondello, who is also the coach of the Australian national team. "She's seen me play in Australia," Taylor said. "She knows my game, and she knows what I can bring to the court given the right opportunity. She said she's going to put me out there and allow me to be myself. That's really all I ask for." With forward Sancho Little, Alana Smith, and Essence Carson injured, rookie Brianna Turner is now starting for the Mercury at power forward, and Dewana Bonner is back at small forward. That left only Camille Little as a reserve post until Taylor was signed. Taylor also has some chemistry with Mercury point guard Leilani Mitchell from their WNBL teammate days in Sydney. Both made the WNBL All-Star 5 in 2017. "Me and her with pick and roll was unstoppable overseas," Taylor said. "I know the girls and they all know my game, so that helps as well. I'm going to be out there going hard and coach won't ever have to question my effort. It's so rare to say you ever played in the league, so I don't want to take that for granted. I know there are a lot of girls that are going to be Hall of Famers, but God sent me on a different path. I just have to be grateful for the opportunity that I'm given and make the most of it." And that was Mercury's Asia Taylor cherishes every chance.
We've got a couple short briefs, news briefs or sports briefs about some Arizona people. UA guard Williams to miss season with knee issue. University of Arizona announced Wednesday that sophomore guard Brandon Williams will miss the entire season while he continues to rehabilitate his knee injury after another surgery. Williams has had a congenital issue in his right knee for over 3 years. UA coach Sean Miller said in a statement, "The news of Brandon's season-ending surgery is beyond disheartening. All of us that comprise Brandon's Arizona basketball family, as well as our own loyal and passionate fan base, will rally around him and support him as he begins his journey to recovery." Williams has suffered since high school with an issue known as osteochondritis dissecans, I guess that's how you say it, which sometimes results in bone and cartilage breaking free and causing pain or restricted motion above his right knee. He is expected to remain on a basketball scholarship and return, if healthy, to play in the 2020-21 season as a redshirt sophomore. Now, this other one is a little different. Arizona archer Ellison sets world record. Brady Ellison of Globe continued his impressive season Wednesday by setting a world archery record, qualifying score at the Pan American Games in Lima, Peru. He's a three-time Olympic medalist. He shot 702, which broke the previous record of 700 by Kim Woo-jin at the 2016 Rio Olympics. Woohoo! Way to go, Ellison. All right, that's all the news briefs we've got, sports briefs we've got. It's time to get on to some editorial stuff.
And I'm going to start that with a column, a piece by Republic columnist Megan U. Boyanton, "Gun Violence Takes Away Right to Live Free." "I have spent my 24 years in comfortable familiarity with firearms. I am a product of the Southern United States, raised far below the Mason-Dixon line. My home state of Louisiana ranks fourth in the country for gun ownership and gun-related deaths. Growing up in the metropolitan area of New Orleans, local headlines about fatal shootings on Bourbon Street or during Mardi Gras season were not uncommon. Even so, practically everyone I knew exercised their Second Amendment rights. My parents both possessed concealed carry permits. The fraternity boys at my undergraduate university in small-town USA were hardly shy about flaunting their hunting rifles after a beer or two. A weekend tradition for my dad and me entailed frequenting an indoor shooting range where he let me practice unloading his pistol into a paper target. Might I add, I'm an adequate markswoman. But this morning, when I noticed the top trending hashtag on Twitter was hashtag it's getting too hard to, an ongoing conversation about surviving in this country amid the seemingly constant gun violence, I had to agree. Now residing in the nation's fifth largest city with well over 1 million neighbors, I can't say the thought of a mass shooting happening here doesn't cross my mind. What if I'm mid-yoga session and a gunman opens fire, like in Tallahassee, Florida last November? What if I'm depositing a check at the bank and the errand ends in my bloody death, like in January's Sebring, Florida shooting? What if I'm taking a test for my graduate program at Arizona State University and find myself facing a gun barrel, like at Charlotte's University of North Carolina this past April? And finally, what if I'm out just grocery shopping for the week at Walmart and become a number in a body count, like in Saturday's El Paso, Texas massacre? What if I'm catching up with friends at a bar and wind up dodging bullets, like in Dayton, Ohio on Sunday? It's maddening, and it used to be easy to brush away the intrusive anxieties and rationalize the occurrences as improbabilities. It could never happen to me, I justified, not in my community. But the reality of the situation is it absolutely could. I can guarantee that 25-year-old Jordan Anchando didn't fathom she'd sacrifice her life to fiercely protect her sons last weekend. The other 21 victims in El Paso didn't have an inkling either that that morning would be their last. As I transitioned from teenager to young adult, my dad incessantly warned me to avoid going out after midnight because misfortune thrives in the wee hours of the morning. But these murders aren't just taking place before the sun rises. American blood is spilling in broad daylight. The only difference between us and these countless casualties is sheer luck, and that's a terrifying realization. My generation isn't birthing nearly as many children. In 2017, the birth rate was the lowest it's been in three decades, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Contributing causes could be the state of the job market and more widespread access to birth control. But time and again, I've also heard peers say, why would I want to bring a baby into this world? My country, our country, treasures its moniker, the land of the free. This typhoon of gun violence is nothing less than an infringement on that cherished independence. Citizens do not deserve this plague of fear. Change isn't just brought about by thoughts and prayers. Change means action, and we desperately need it. And that was Megan Uboyanton's column, Gun Violence Takes Away Right to Live Free.
E.J. Montini's column is entitled Defense of GOP Senator Revives an Ugly Diatribe. Just when we were beginning to forget about Arizona Senator Sylvia Allen's bigoted remarks about the browning of America and how the U.S. is going to look like South American countries and how immigrants are flooding us, the state senator's whole ugly diatribe has been brought up again by Republicans? Well, specifically, by Republican Arizona Senate President Karen Fann, who emerged from wherever she was hiding while the Allen controversy raged to attempt to defend her. Only she chose to do so when Allen was more or less an afterthought, when we had practically forgotten about her, and during what is the worst possible week based on the awful events in Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas. Fann issued a statement saying in part, "The attacks on Senator Allen are unwarranted and unfair." She added that Allen is a kind, warm-hearted person who does not condone any form of bigotry and prejudice. Well, we should point out, first, that Allen was not attacked. She was quoted. She said what she said. She later tried to qualify it, to explain it, but she said it. And now comes Fann, just after a massacre by a white nationalist terrorist linked to a ranting manifesto that speaks about an invasion of immigrants, trying to excuse a fellow politician who spoke of how we have a right as a country to have people coming in an organized manner so we know who are coming. We can't provide that when people are just flooding us and flooding us and flooding us and overwhelming us. Why would a fellow Republican want to remind us of that? Fann said that Allen has explained her comments, detailing the intent, and even offered apologies to anyone who misconstrued the intent. Again, no. The problem is not that people misconstrued the content. The problem, at least for Republicans, is that people understood Allen perfectly. That's why Allen was compared to shamed former Republican lawmaker David Stringer. But all of that happened before the attack in El Paso, from which we are finally coming to the frightful realization of the inherent danger of inflammatory language about immigrants and those of other ethnicities. We can only learn, get better, become more understanding, if we remember what someone like Allen said. But the sad fact is, we were beginning to forget. We were practically there. The news of today buries the news of yesterday. Why Fann would choose to dig up Allen's words during those terrible days? It's mind-boggling. And that's E.J. Montini's column, Defense of GOP Senator Revives an Ugly Diatribe.
And from columnist Froma Harrop, Good Men with Guns Won't Protect Us. It was a remarkable 13 hours in American history. A mass shooting in Dayton, Ohio, taking 9 lives, was overshadowed by a massacre in El Paso, Texas, costing 21. Others are dwelling on the El Paso gunman's alleged online manifesto about Hispanics' growing political clout in Texas and Donald Trump's use of code words appearing to validate the frothing. But here, let's discuss the guns themselves. Even the Trump-loving New York Post is now calling for a ban on assault weapons as demands for gun control have swelled. This puts the National Rifle Association, bankrolled by makers of these killing machines, under new pressure. Expect to hear the usual arguments. Only one of them is semi-respectable. That is, the way to stop a bad man with a gun is to have a good man with a gun take him down. With guns already flooding America, one can't totally dismiss this logic. Except it doesn't work in practice. There is almost never such a person on the scene, even in Texas. In nearly all cases, the good men with guns are members of law enforcement who rush to the scene. Police in Dayton reached the suspect in less than a minute, but by then he had already killed 9 people. Some insist that customers at the Walmart in El Paso should have been armed. Really? Has America reached a stage where Saturday shoppers looking for towels are thought careless for not keeping a gun in their handbag? The NRA pushes the myth that Stephen Wilford, a good man with a gun, somehow stopped a deadly rampage in Sutherland Springs, Texas. Except he didn't. Wilford confronted the attacker after he had fatally shot worshippers at First Baptist Church. Was the killer prevented from continuing his rampage elsewhere? Perhaps. But 26 churchgoers dead was hardly a victory. The theory also operates on the assumption that the good man can shoot straight and keep his cool when confronted with a totally chaotic scene of carnage. Even well-trained members of the military sometimes hit innocents. And note the instances in which even armed professional guards were afraid to rush in on a maniac. In the Las Vegas massacre, the worst mass shooting in U.S. history, the targets at a country music concert could not have fought back, even if they had been armed to the teeth. The gunman was holed up on the 32nd floor of a nearby hotel with 23 guns, including 12 assault weapons, by his side. It took a SWAT team to break into the room, and by then, 58 were fatally shot. Laws that would keep guns away from the mentally ill and ban weapons of war, let experts designate them, are, of course, essentially. They would not infringe on hunters' activities and could leave plenty of options for those who want firearms for self-defense. Barring major changes, there is no reason to believe that these tragedies won't continue. Every mass shooting makes the act seem more normal in the minds of evil and/or unhinged individuals. Social media has created a community of the perverted, sharing their twisted manifestos and praising perpetrators of outrageous deeds. Deranged weaklings will continue to think that it's manly to shoot unarmed adults and children in the back. The maker of the AR-15 style weapon and the massacre of 20 elementary school children and 6 adults in Newtown, Connecticut, marketed its products with lines like, "Consider your man card reissued." The mentally ill will always be with us, and they're in every country. As far as personal safety is concerned, I'd much prefer a psychotic man without a gun to a good man with one. And that was from a Harrop's column, "Good Men with Guns Won't Protect Us."
We've got time for a couple letters to the editor. And there's 2 of them here. They're right next to each other, and they're on opposite sides of the spectrum. So I thought I'd read the 2 of them. "I heard our 45th president after the dual mass shootings last weekend. His voice was wooden, lacking the emotional emphasis typical of those who care about their topics. It was obvious he did not have any concern for the issues and none of the competence to deal with them, nor did he apologize for his contributions to the climate of hatred. Many of his supporters promote him because he speaks what is on his mind. They ignore that he sidled up to the Russians and even asked for their illegal assistance in his campaign. He embraced Putin against our intelligence and law enforcement agencies, but we seem to have forgotten his treason. Why does it seem bad to some to impeach this incompetent traitor?" Signed, Bolin Moonward from Whitman. And the next letter goes like this. "It seems that the Democratic candidates and CNN are suffering from political dyslexia when calling Donald Trump a racist. Let's try to remind them of the actual history of bigotry, especially in the South. Who strutted and proudly sponsored legislation to fly the stars and bars over the South Carolina State House? Why, it was Democratic Senator Fritz Hollings, then governor, and his Democratic legislature voted right along with him. Who for a time led the Ku Klux Klan, responsible for anti-black terrorism for decades? Well, it was Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate general, Southern politician, and a Democrat. And who were the lingering heroes of segregation standing in schoolhouse portals and loosening dogs on peaceful protesters? You know, George Wallace, Bull Connor, Huey Long, and countless other Democrats? And finally, who was the most racially divisive president we've ever had, who managed to twist race into every national tragedy? Well, his name was Barack Obama, and well, you know. That was signed Rod Hartman from Phoenix. Well, those are the two contrasting letters to the editor, and we're coming up on 8:45, so let's do some entertainment.
And I'm sorry to say that when I look at the horoscope column for today, there is no special horoscope for today.
No birthdays?
But nonetheless, we wish you, if your birthday is August 8th, happy birthday. And here's what we can tell you about Aries. Aries are born between March 21st and April 19th. Dominance and aggression are poor ways to hold on to power. You'll get an example of this today.
For Taurus, April 20th to May 20th, how well do you understand people? Don't guess. Test it out.
Gemini, May 21 to June 21. When you genuinely care about the people you're with, the qualities of leadership naturally flow from you.
For Cancer, June 22nd through July 22nd, much will be said without words. Because you're paying attention, you will get the real story, not the one in the brochure.
Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd. Whatever your weakness, that's part of the design that can be worked with, possibly made so strong that it's the best part of the package.
For you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, there are people in the business of helping others who only really help themselves.
Libra, September 23rd to October 23rd. When you don't like where you end up, and you seem to end up there more often than not, those activities just aren't working.
For Scorpio, October 24th through November 21st, the thing you do in the moment might be impulsive or awkward, or might lack a certain amount of emotional control that you wish you could claim. Who cares?
Sagittarius, November 22nd to December 21st. Pointing fingers will be a temptation. Of course, it wouldn't bother you about another person if you didn't notice the quality somewhere in yourself.
Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. With goal setting, getting the scale right is tricky. Big enough to make a detectable difference, but not so big as to be unattainable.
Aquarius, January 20 through February 18th. The same structure that protects us and brings shelter in our day-to-day life can also be a cage.
And Pisces, February 19th to March 20th. It's as though you've been through this scenario already in some kind of simulated drill. Oh, my goodness.
And Karina Bland's column today, it's just a straw, but it doesn't have to be the last one. We were in line at the concession stand at the movie theater when my two friends pulled reusable straws from their purses. Nikki, whose telescoping straw came in a small case, said she got it after she cleaned out her car of all the paper wrappers from straws and realized how many she used. Rhonda stopped buying plastic water bottles and bought a reusable steel straw because actor Jason Momoa, who played Aquaman, posted on social media that people should stop using so much plastic because it winds up in the ocean. Rhonda would do anything for Aquaman. I suddenly felt responsible for every sea turtle with a plastic drinking straw stuck up its nostril. I could carry my own straw, I decided. I had one at home, a gift from a friend. After a week of carrying the thing, I learned Diet Coke tastes better through stainless steel, and using my own straw gave me the same guilt-free satisfaction as when I remembered to bring my reusable bags into the grocery store. I found myself reading about plastic in the ocean. It's not just turtles and other sea life that ends up ingesting plastic. It's us, too. Plastic breaks down in the ocean and turns up in sea salt, shellfish, and tap water. Ew. I know straws are only a small portion of the plastic in the ocean, but it's easy for me to say no to one. Some people with mobility and medical issues can't. and it made me think more often about what else I could do to lessen my impact on the environment. Carry a reusable drink bottle, use containers with lids instead of Ziploc bags. Sometimes I leave the straw behind, drying on a tea towel next to the kitchen sink. On those days, I opt not to use a straw at all. Diet Coke tastes even better that way. And that was Karina Bland. It's just a straw, but it doesn't have to be the last one.
Okay, we turn now to Dear Abby. Looks like we've got two letters today. The first one goes like this. I will soon be retiring from a lay position in my church. As a former member of the choir, I'm being urged to return to it, which appeals to me. But my problem is a member who has caused trouble in the past for me with lies and criticism. I'm afraid if I rejoin the choir, the situation will continue. I don't want to upset the other choir members who are good, supportive friends, but I no longer want to have to put up with her. So, any suggestions? Signed, Singing a New Tune in Canada.
And Dear Abby responds, Dear Singing, if you haven't already done so, discuss this with the priest or pastor of your church. Explain how the woman's bullying and rumor spreading have affected you and ask for guidance.
Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, my son moved in with a 22-year-old woman in 2009. She gave birth to a baby boy in 2010. My son, who is older, took on the responsibility of raising the boy. In 2018, she walked out on them both and wasn't heard from again. Through public records, we found out she had committed suicide. My grandson is now 9. My question is he old enough to be told about his mother, or should my son wait until he's older, like in his teens? Signed, Right Time in Florida.
Dear Right Time, when your grandson asks about his mother, he should be told she is no longer living. As he begins asking for more information, his questions should be answered in an age-appropriate way. He does not need to hear that she committed suicide until he is old enough to understand.
All right, time for some comics. I got Baby Blues. Wanda and the kids are out at a fire, and she's got a marshmallow on a stick. And it looks like it's on fire, and she goes, ooh, this marshmallow looks about done, Zoe. And she hands the stick to Zoe, and she says, wait till it cools before you eat it. And Zoe goes, ooh, white goop on a dirty stick. Oh, yum. And so Mom says, well, then give it to Hammy. And Hammy goes, got any more white goop?
And in Peanuts, if you were listening yesterday, you may recall that Snoopy was injured in the softball game or the baseball game. So now he's at the vet, and we see him sitting on the vet's table, and he's thinking, I hate life. No matter what you do, you always end up at the vet. And he's thinking, I heard a million times, take him to the vet, give him a shot, give him a pill, hold him down, put a muzzle on him, lock him in a kennel, chain him to a post. And Snoopy's thinking, no wonder dogs howl at the moon.
Aww. Blondie, Dagwood's at work at his desk working on his computer, and another worker comes in and says, hey, the guy who stocks our vending machines told me he's going to load them with everything from soup to nuts. And Dagwood goes, ooh, sweet. And the guy takes a sip out of his coffee and says, sure. And as he walks out the door, he says, if you like soup or nuts.
And in Beetle Bailey, two soldiers are getting up from their military cots. And one says, ow, my back is killing me. And another says, maybe you slept in an awkward position last night. And the first one looks over at Beetle, who is asleep in, I can't even describe this position. He's all twisted around. His legs are going one way. His head and stomach are going the other. And the first guy says, that never bothers Beetle.
And for Zitz, Jeremy is down in the basement with his mom. And he's got 4 piles of laundry. And the washing machine's open, and he's ready to load the laundry. And he's telling his mom as he points, he says, so I have ripped, frayed, ironic, and funky. Those are his 4 piles of laundry. And his mom says, you know, most people sort their laundry by color. And he says, well, if I did that, I'd have 1 pile of bluish, brownish gray.
And pickles. Opal says to Earl, "Earl, did you fix the backyard fence yet?" And Earl says, "The fence? Yes, that definitely needs fixing, and it's on my top. It's on the top of my list of things to do." And Opal says, "Good." And Earl looks down at the paper in front of him and says, "Right after I read the complete works of William Shakespeare."
Okay, non sequitur. The little girl, I think her name is Danae, is standing on a podium, the Church of Danae. And next to the sign, it says, "New and Improved Perfection." And the little boy says, "Just what does this sign mean?" And Danae yells, "That we're better than all the other religions." And he looks up at her and says, "Well, every religion claims the same thing." And she says, "Yeah, but they're all wrong." And he says, "They all say that too." And so she stops and thinks, and then she yells, "Contrary facts are blasphemy." And he goes, "Okay, once again." And she goes, "Ah."
And in Pearls Before Swine, Pig is making a list. He says, "What I want for my birthday." And the first item is love. And Goat comes along and says, "Aw, that's what makes you such a great soul, Pig. What else could one want from life?" And Pig says, "More panel width?" And then we see that underneath love, he has written gloves, G-L-O-V-E-S, and a widened panel. And Goat says, "Never mind." And Pig says, "No, so why am I a great soul?"
Drabble's got kind of a interesting cartoon today. In the first frame, the Wally, the dachshund, is chasing the cat, and the cat's running to the left. And in the second frame, the cat screeches to a halt in front of the sprinkler, and Wally's catching up. And then in the last frame, the cat has turned directions. He's now running to the right, and Wally's running right behind him. But the cat is screeching to a halt because he's about to run into the swimming pool. And Wally the dachshund says, "The dog days of summer are a blast."
And a couple of birthdays from today. Actress Nita Talbot is 89, and actor Dustin Hoffman is 82.
Wow.
Yeah, country singer Phil Balsley of the Statler Brothers is 80. Actor Larry Wilcox from Chips is 72. Actor Keith Carradine, Madam Secretary, is 70. And there are some other birthdays, but I think we're out of time. We need to take a break for a few minutes.
Stay with my love. It's understood.